Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And boy, I was really interested in this talking to our first guest about her book, Samarkand, A Journey, a Culinary Journey Through Central Asia, a subject I knew absolutely nothing about.
Yeah, we were surprised how ignorant we were.
Well, it was embarrassing, but I learned a lot talking to Caroline Eden.
And you're going to learn a lot too, and all about the Silk Road, all about Uzbekistan, and oh well, why don't we just run the tape?
Exactly. Well, I've had a real revelation with this book by Caroline Eden and Eleanor Ford called Samarkand, Recipes and Stories from Central Asia and the Caucasus. I honestly, Caroline Eden, I am shocked that I'm so ignorant about that whole part of the world. Could you sort of place it in people's minds geographically, and then we'll talk about some of the cultural influences?
I certainly can, and I have to say, you are not alone. This is a region that a lot of people probably know more about the moon than they know about Central Asia. It's a very big part of Asia, but there's not very much known about it. Samarkand is a city in Uzbekistan, which is really the heartland of Central Asia. It's a very ancient trading city. It's not the capital. The capital's Tashkent.
Oh, Samarkand, I thought it was the capital. I didn't know that. Okay.
Tashkent's the capital, so it's sort of north of Samarkand. To place it very generally, geographically, to give your listeners and you some idea about where we're talking about, you've got China to the east. Above it, you've got the giant land of Kazakhstan, which is the world's ninth biggest country.
Below it,
you've got Afghanistan. And sort of traveling west, you've got the Caucasus going on to Europe. So this is really a place that has been at the center of the Silk Road for a very long time, which is what makes it so interesting.
And your background is you were a travel writer, and your partner in this book, Eleanor, is the recipe developer and more than that, but the food person, right?
That's right. That's the way we've worked together on this particular book.
But you had, on a journey there, the idea struck you that this was a book that had to be written. And why is that?
Well, that's true. And lots of people have asked me, like, why did you do this book? And I've been traveling in this region for many years. And what occurred to me on these journeys was that food had a really bad reputation back home. People would talk about, you know, all kinds of very bland food, uninteresting food, sort of survival fare. And this really struck me as unfair because the food that you eat in people's homes is actually very interesting and very varied and quite different to the food that they serve in tourist restaurants. Tourism in this region is really small. It's not like other parts of Asia, like, say, India or China or Southeast Asia.
Well, it's difficult to get to. I mean, it's...
It's difficult to get to. Not so much is known about it. So, unfortunately, that people are learning in Central Asia that, you know, creative, varied menus in tourist restaurants are a good idea. But at the moment, you'll sort of get the same four or five dishes on the menu because that's what they think people know and that's what they think people will want. So it doesn't reflect the wonderful things in the market, which are fabulous, organic, sun-ripened fruits, really good meat, herbs, spices, nuts, basically everything that you would recognize, say, in a country like Turkey. There's a lot of similarities to give people an idea. If you think of a Turkish bazaar, you're kind of somewhere there.
Well, sort of, Turkey's sort of one end of the Silk Road, isn't it, really? Anyway.
Yes, absolutely. And those flavors are more prevalent in the Caucasus. So the book's really two regions. It's Central Asia and the Caucasus. And, of course, the Caucasus are very close geographically to Turkey. So when I'm talking about the Caucasus, I'm talking about the South Caucasus. So that's Azerbaijan, Armenia, and Georgia. And you see a lot more of Turkish influence there. But Turkish food is very fashionable now in Uzbekistan.
Oh, yeah,
everybody eats kebabs, for example.
Well, the whole Middle Eastern profile is big now. Middle Eastern is hot trend.
Now, this region of the world, though, has really changed. I mean, it was an area of trade and cultural exchange on a massive scale when trade and culture exchange didn't happen very much at all.
13th century,
going back close to 1,000 years, I'm guessing, right?
Well, that's right. So really from the 6th to the 13th century, Samarkand was the world's great shopfront. I mean, there's a lot of misconception about the Silk Road, and I'll just speak really briefly about this because it's quite
interesting in terms of food.
When people picture the Silk Road, they tend to think of enormous camel caravans, quite hard to say that, traveling from China all the way through to, say, Italy or Istanbul. And that wasn't really how it worked. Small groups would travel small distances, and it was like a relay.
Ah.
And nearly all of them would pass through Samarkand.
Wow. Now, I mean,
so when you look at it like that, for that very long period of history, you had a lot of different nationalities and ethnic groups passing through this city and leaving their culinary stamp. Now, some of this is a bit sort of academic nowadays, but the history is there, and that's what's really interesting.
Yeah, I was surprised. I'd never heard of the Conqueror. What's Tamerlane?
Tamerlane, yeah.
I never heard of Tamerlane, though. That historically, that's a bit boo-boo not to have known about Tamerlane, right?
Tamerlane is quite an interesting character. He has sort of, since the fall of the Soviet Union 25 years ago, he has really become the new pin-up of Uzbekistan. So when you go to Uzbekistan, you don't see statues of Lenin or Stalin anymore. What you see are statues of Tamerlane, 14th century conqueror, who built Samarkand as his capital. And to build this fabulous capital, he brought masons, people, wonderful craftsmen from all over the lands that he conquered, in countries like India and Syria and Turkey, to build this fabulous city. So when you travel to Samarkand, it really is, in terms of the architecture, time travel back to the 14th century in Tamerlane's capital.
Now, juxtaposed with the Soviet era buildings, you say.
Well, hold on a second.
Yes, the mix is there. You still see the big, sort of slightly grim, coming down.
But, now, how is Tamerlane like Genghis Khan and Kublai Khan, who were they a little bit further east?
Well, they're all Mongol tribes, so, I mean, they're connected.
And they are, okay.
Yeah, they are connected. So Tamerlane is linked to Genghis Khan. They're similar tribes.
Okay.
Well, you know, I explained to you that we have our nephew married a Mongolian woman, an MD who lives in England, but they go back and forth a lot. And I wasn't all that impressed with photographs of some of their food, like a big goat's head in a pot, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
Well, they have a goat's head. She has a goat's head in a pot recipe in this book.
Oh, do you?
What's it called? Is it plov?
Oh, plov is
plov. Yeah. I mean, where to start with this? I mean, this is kind of one of the, forgive me, but one of the misconceptions. In Central Asia, there's a real split between the steppe, so the big rolling pasture land, and the cities. So Uzbekistan is more of a settled country than, say, Kazakhstan or Mongolia. So the cities that have existed in Uzbekistan for hundreds and hundreds of years, the food there is more varied, and it's more the food of settled culture. So kebabs.
That's a great way of putting it. Yeah.
And it's kind of, that's the difference. Whereas out on the steppe, it's very, very basic.
Oh, yes.
So a lot of dairy and a lot of meat and not very much else.
Fermented camel milk with vodka. No, horse milk. Fermented horse milk with vodka was served at one of the weddings that they went to.
You have to be quite brave.
Tell me, our listeners here, in your book, you break down the different contributing cultures,
mm-hmm.
And some of them are quite surprising.
And
you know, I already told you I was surprised about the Korean, but could you just go over that part of it, all these are contributing to the culture and the culinary scene.
Absolutely. So I kind of identify with this book seven groups of people that historically and more recently have left their mark on Samarkand, this great trading city, over the centuries. Tajikistan is just across the border. Samarkand is really a Tajik city rather than an Uzbek city, although this is debatable. Russians, obviously more recently. Turks, historically Turks have had great trading with this part of the world.
Sure.
Jews, there's a long history of Jews in Samarkand, but more so in Bukhara, which is the sort of sister historical city in Uzbekistan. Jews from this part of the world sometimes say that they belong to one of the lost tribes, but the more likely explanation is that they came with Tamerlane, because Tamerlane, as sort of wonderful craftsmen, they were sort of brought over in the sort of 10th.
I think he said something.
14th century.
He said some. Who was it? Post World War II, the Jews were resettled or expelled.
That's the Koreans.
And that's the Koreans.
The Jews. The reason I stumbled with the dates there is because when I was in Bukhara recently, I saw a 10th century Torah in the synagogue.
Wow.
Which was quite incredible. And I'm thinking now, I wonder how that got there, because the belief is that they came with Tamerlane, and of course he was 14th century. So we don't really know, but there is a Jewish community still existing, very small numbers, there today. And of course, Anne, you mentioned the Koreans.
That's amazing, yeah.
The Koreans are really curious, although the explanation is quite simple. Stalin exiled a lot of Koreans.
That's what I was thinking of, right.
Yeah, into Central Asia before the war, and they have stayed on. So it's very easy to see these women. They facially look quite different to the Kyrgyz or the Kazakhs or the Uzbeks. And in the markets, they all sell these carrot salads.
Oh, yes, carrots. You said in the most remote city, you'll find a carrot.
It was the thing that confused me. How did Stalin have any Koreans in the first place? I mean, how did he have any to get rid of?
They were living in the Russian Far East, as I remember.
Okay, got it. Okay, so they were in jail.
He was worried that they were going to start causing him problems. Okay. So along with, obviously, lots of other groups, he sent them out into Central Asia, primarily to Uzbekistan, but all across the region, really. Okay. And they have stayed on.
So they were beyond the Silk Road, in a sense. They were on the border of Korea itself, which is far, far, much further east.
Yes, and what's interesting with the Koreans is that they're who you go to if you want some spice, because Central Asian food, unlike lots of other types of Asian food, is not spicy.
Right, but you get the hot in the Korean. You get really hot spicy. It's very popular
right.
now.
And they do put chilies in their carrot salads. They're called the Koryo Saram, which literally means Korean people. That's what they're called locally. So, yeah, they're very interesting. And then the next group we have are the Caucasians. And as I was explaining earlier, that's the Southern Caucasus, so Georgia, Azerbaijan, Armenia.
Could you tell me something? I said to Peter, why is it that we're identified as as Caucasians when we don't have anything to do with the Caucasus?
It's a very good question. And I have Googled it myself in the past, and I can't think off the top of my head why that is.
Okay.
Well, when you find out when you email us, and then we can.
I certainly will. It is a good question, and it does always feel strange. But yeah, you know, it's not a word we use very much in Britain. I don't know if it's more of an American thing.
It's the answer to the question race, which I give on many of the forms I have to fill out.
That's
for
right.
a variety
right.
of different
it's
reasons.
Kind of the only time you see it, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
I want to sing Donald Swan, the English, your best. I wouldn't give tuppence for all the rest. Never mind this Caucasian stupidity. But talk to us about some of these other wonderful looking recipes. I mean, the pictures just are absolutely gorgeous.
Well, there's so many similarities. You're not surprised at all to see so much pomegranate, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, it's landlocked, so you would have meat-centric cuisine, right?
That's right. Apart from Turkmenistan, which is on the Caspian Sea, and Kazakhstan is also on the Caspian Sea. But that's why we have Eleanor created this wonderful fish plov. Plov is a pilaf. It's a rice dish.
Yeah, the plov is universal, you say, this area.
It's the quintessential dish of Uzbekistan. The Uzbeks cook it particularly well. Yeah.
And you do. You bake it, put it together, and cook it in layers.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now, hold on a second. Doesn't caviar come from the big lake?
That's right.
Okay.
Caviar, the best types of caviar in the world all come from the Caspian Sea, three types.
Which is on the edge of the Caucasus.
That's right. So Azerbaijan, I've bought caviar in Azerbaijan. Obviously, Russia is also bordering the Caspian. The sturgeon that's in the Caspian. Not exclusively, because I always used to think the sturgeon only existed in the Caspian, but it doesn't. It actually exists in the States. It exists in Israel. But the best types of... they're probably farmed. The best types of sturgeon are in the Caspian Sea.
Well, there's
a
lot of
fraud. There's a little bit of fish.
The what?
But really not very much. It's very heavily meat focused. Okay, you're quite right.
One of the more interesting dishes I think that I was reading about was this pomegranate soup.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me that this is a taste profile that's very common in this area, this sweet, tart, and complex combination.
That's right. So, definitely.
Yeah, I'd like to make that soup, actually.
Well, that's good. It's a nice sort of summery soup. It's very light. And pomegranates do feature quite heavily in the cuisine right throughout the region, from the Caucasus into Central Asia. And they really bring some sweet flavors, as do barberries and quince. So often the plovs that you eat in Uzbekistan will have quince in it.
Uh-huh.
It's quite a complex cuisine we're talking about, really.
And I don't know about... You try... I mean... Those of you pick dishes or created dishes. You didn't just replicate traditional recipes. You actually played around with these recipes, you said.
That's quite right. So we are not claiming that this is an authentic Central Asian / Caucasian cookery book, because neither of us are from the region, obviously, and it's almost impossible to recreate the dishes completely in an authentic way. So the vast, vast majority of the recipes are Eleanor's creations that she has come up with through her travels to Uzbekistan and through research. And some of them, a handful, are recipes that I've brought back with me from my travels further around the region that she's created in her kitchen to make them really accessible to the home cook. So what's great, I think, about the recipes in the book is they're not difficult. And they don't require an absolute store cupboard full of hard-to-find ingredients.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, if you really tried to replicate the traditional dishes, I mean, how many people have access to camel meat?
Well, exactly.
Well, actually, my nephew's wife served us camel meat, and I would say that people from that area must have pretty strong teeth.
Yeah, I think strong teeth and strong stomachs.
It was called dried meat. And they had just been to Mongolia, so they brought some back with them. Now,
and they brought that through okay.
We didn't ask. We just ate it, and it was fairly chewy. It's sort of like you lost weight as a result of the energy involved in chewing the meat.
Excellent, that's my kind of food.
Hold on a second. I wanted to get something in here. I've been waiting for 5 minutes.
Okay.
You better like eggplant. Right?
Yes.
Oh.
You better really like eggplant.
I like eggplant.
Eggplant's all the way through these recipes.
Yeah, well, we have a lot of eggplant here. But we're
obviously very popular in Turkish cuisine. It's the kind of sultan of the vegetable in Turkey.
And
that also, prevalent everywhere. And I write in the book that the biggest aubergines I've ever seen were in Baku, the capital of Azerbaijan, where they were the size of a rugby ball. and bigger. This gentleman was very proud. He had absolutely enormous aubergines to sell. I mean, the thing is, I think the smaller ones are probably sweeter. But, yes, you're right. Eggplant or aubergine, as we call it. Yes, you better like it. It's true.
And the other thing that was surprising is the popularity of mulberries, because they fall off the trees in Pittsburgh here. Nobody even picks them, you know.
Yes, they're very, very sought after in Turkey and Central Asia. I've written an essay just on mulberries in the book, explaining a little bit about the history and the importance of the mulberry. For me, though, it's really melons, and we don't have melon recipes. That's the one thing I think we've probably missed out. But melons are amazing in Central Asia.
Well, I saw in the photograph you had, I said to Peter, you know, they have all these exotic melons that we don't have as well.
Yeah.
One of the markets you had.
They're just so sweet. They really are. Once you've had melons in Uzbekistan, you don't really ever want to have them anywhere else.
No, that's like if you go into South America and you get mangoes.
Wow, yeah.
But I have one other question here is, you said you've traveled a lot. I mean, what motivates you? You're a travel writer. Is it just because it's exotic? Why have you spent so much time in this part of the world?
Well, to be honest, it was kind of because no one else was. And I was working for a publisher who was publishing books, a lot of books, on this part of the world. And I had a handful of contacts, so I had a bit of confidence to book a flight and go. And I don't know, I sort of always support the underdog, and it seemed very unfair to me that everybody goes to India and China and no one was going to this enormous part of Asia. And you know, if you like Mughal architecture like I do, the home of Mughal architecture is really in Uzbekistan, because Babur, the founder of the Mughal Empire, is from modern day Uzbekistan. So if you're interested in the history of the Silk Road, or if you're interested in China or India, it does make sense to visit, and it's very addictive once you start going, because you kind of want to learn more.
Well, it's a wonderful book and a great contribution to, culturally and culinary, I think.
Thank you.
So, Caroline Eden, again, the book is Samarkand, and I challenge the readers to get to know a not very well-known area of the world.
Thank you very much for having me on your show.
Thanks, Caroline.
This Samarkand and Uzbekistan and the Silk Road, it sounds kind of like a fairly adventurous place to go.
Yeah, I think so.
For a young lady from Scotland, but I guess she's gone enough time, she must feel like it's safe to be there.
Remember.
Yeah, she's English, but she lives in Scotland.
Right.
Well, we don't know what part of we don't know what country she's going to be a part of soon. That's just a hint of what's happening with all this Brexit nonsense.
Right.
And whether or not the home countries are going to split apart, we don't know. I guess one of these days we might have to devote a program to that. But in the meantime, we're certainly happy to share with you the story of Samarkand and the Silk Road, and I'm sure you found it very interesting. And we'll be back with another fascinating segment right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. I'm glad you're joining us in this romp through Exotica, as I should call it.
There we go. That's a fancy title for it.
And our next author is also an English, England-living person.
We're an adventurous lot.
Exactly. A Sirocco, Fabulous Flavors from the East by, and we're going to be talking to, Sabrina Gayor.
And for those people who like me recognize the word Sirocco and wonder why, it's actually the name of a wind, but it's a wind that happens to occur in the North African coast, which is of course the subject area for the recipes and things described in the book and described in our conversation. So just Just not to be confused. Think of it, if you like, if you're a Californian, as the North African equivalent of a Santa Ana wind. And anyway, let's go to the tape.
You know, the title of this book, of course, expresses the whole concept of the book. It's called Sirocco. And Sabrina Geyer, is that correct?
That is correct, yes,
Greg,
thank you.
Explain the significance of this title.
So I chose the name Sirocco because I wanted a title. I always like to have a title that refers to some element of me or the book, or kind of has some kind of connection. And Sirocco is a warm wind that starts in the Sahara, and it starts from the east and it blows west towards the Mediterranean. And in a way, it kind of represents my style of cooking, which is I start with what are perceived to be Eastern ingredients, and I cook very kind of Western, familiar-feeling, just everyday recipes. But for the sake of people, we'll kind of call it Middle Eastern, because obviously it has a flavor base there.
You live in London. But your heritage...
I was born in Tehran.
Oh, okay. So I was going to say your heritage, Persian.
That's right, yes, Iranian.
Iranian. Well, I said Persian because your first book was Persiana.
Persiana, yeah.
And it's such a nice. Why did we stop calling Iran Persia?
You know what? I'm not too aware of exactly what the reason was. I just know around the time that it changed, basically. It's such a shame because it rolls off the tongue so beautifully, and it's got such an air of romantic
right.
Sort of feeling to it.
It was when they threw the ruler out.
I'm told it was a little bit before that, just
before that,
I believe,
okay.
The British put the Pahlavis in power.
Uh-huh.
Well, so now, it was a little bit before that.
How did you get from there to England, and at what age?
I came to England age 2 at the time of the revolution, and we already had some family that lived here, and my mom had a little place here that, you know, because she used to study here in England as well, so there was a lot of, it wouldn't have been our first trip out. So when we left, you know, we left as refugees and, you know, set out for life in England, and I couldn't be more grateful to have been given such a chance to be, you know, in this country I call my home and I still love so much. So, and I feel very British, but also, you know, very Iranian too. It's a wonderful combination of cultures, and I very much have always felt that I've always been free to be who I am.
Well, you know, you note that you learned actually to cook from your grandmother and your great aunt, who were sisters, I gather. So you knew all the flavor profiles that you were bringing into a new environment. And also you modernized everything. So I think that pretty much describes the tone of this cookbook, except that it leaves out this one little bit. Is you have an absolutely marvelous creative bent and inventiveness to your recipes.
Thank you. I think, if anything, the reason that comes across in my style is because, actually, I didn't learn from my grandmother. My grandmother's sister was a fantastic cook, but she was not in my house.
I see.
So I had my grandmother, who really didn't cook at all. It wasn't something she'd ever learned, and then all of a sudden had to come to England and learn from a, you know, family a couple of a few recipes to kind of keep the house afloat.
Uh-huh.
And she would just cook once every couple of months. She'd, you know, pick a Sunday aside and cook loads of food and freeze it and then defrost as necessary. So I didn't have that repertoire at home. I didn't even pay attention so much on the odd occasions where she was cooking. So I'm self-taught in the sense that, and that's probably why I have these flavor combinations, because nobody ever really was around me in the kitchen and they just let me do my thing and play around with flavors. So I cooked with a confidence that you don't get if somebody's watching over you telling you, no, don't do this and this is not how we do it and you have to do that and don't go in the kitchen right now, have that. So I had free rein of things, and it made me very unafraid, as I had no one to please other than myself. So, you know, I got to know what I liked, and, you know, eventually learned that people like those flavors too. So it was just, it comes quite naturally to me, which is what it should be. I would wish that for everyone, because if everybody could just cook comfortably and doesn't have to be complicated, but just feel comfortable while doing it, you know, everything changes.
Strongly recommend an accessible pantry. But I'll tell you, you have things in your pantry that I don't have in mine.
Yeah.
Can you run through some of them?
That's okay, because, you know, the good thing about my kind of cooking is that's perfectly okay. You can totally leave it out, switch it up, put something else in. These aren't hard and fast rules. In my cooking, there are no hard and fast rules, because home cooking doesn't have those rules in any culture. It's always based on availability, what you had, what you could afford, and what needed to be used up, because that's sustainable, you know, a way of life. So I don't mind that people don't have everything, but, you know, a lot of cupboards around the world are fairly well stocked, not maybe with the more specialty items, but, you know, like turmeric is fairly mainstream now, not just, you know, I'm not talking about the fresh stuff, but the dried stuff. A lot of countries use it in one thing or another. So you don't have to have too many additional things one way or another, just a few extra flavors that you like, you know.
Yeah, I love za'atar, but I didn't realize that there were so many variations on it. You explained that it's not just one thing. I knew it was a blend, but I didn't realize there were so many options.
Yeah, somebody we interviewed told us that once. They said one person's za'atar isn't nearly the same as another one.
Yeah.
And it's so, they made the comparison between that and curry powder in India and Pakistan and Thailand, where again, everybody has their own version of it. It was really interesting with the turmeric to see you using, well, I'm assuming since it was in teaspoons, that the recipe for salmon, the turmeric in that is dried and powdered.
Yeah.
Peter's going to make that, by the way.
But then a few pages before, you have what you call Eastern fish and chips, and there the turmeric is fresh. And
all different ways to use it, and it doesn't have to be fresh. It could also be dried. You know, it's just easily done.
Well, we got hooked on the fresh root.
It's fresh stuff.
Yeah. I'll share something with you. This is actually published under my name, because I invented it, and it's called a turmertini.
Turmertini. Wow.
It's very thinly sliced fresh turmeric and gin.
Wow.
Preferably London dry gin.
Wow. Yeah, I haven't put it in a cocktail yet.
Try it. It's great.
It's great in a
Manhattan. It's great in a Negroni. Both of which have a little bit of a sweet edge about them, but it's best in gin.
Yeah, I'm not a big drinker, unfortunately, I have to say.
Well, then maybe that's why you haven't tried it, then.
From the thaw, in all fairness.
Our listeners really like the details of flavors. Could you just pick out some of your, I'd like particularly an example or examples of where you've westernized Eastern ingredients and modernized the recipe. Do you have anything that comes to mind that you could use as an example of this?
In this book, I haven't really sort of taken any traditional recipes. I've just come up with all my own sort of stuff, but I do use ingredients in non-traditional ways. You know,
right.
Even simple stuff like pomegranate seeds. In the Middle East, we don't eat them in salads. Now they're trending and they're in everything in every country in the Middle East. But traditionally, we only eat pomegranate as fruit. You know, it's not something that makes it into savory dishes, certainly not something that makes it into hot dishes unless it's in molasses form. But for example, take pomegranate molasses. You know, traditionally in Iran, it's in one stew and one soup. You know, it's a pomegranate soup and it's a pomegranate walnut stew. stew with chicken or duck or little meatballs traditionally. But, you know, I love to use it in so many different ways. I use it in marinades for fish, for chicken, for seafood. I use it as a drizzle on pancakes when I've got, like, another sweet compote on it. I use it in drink syrups. I've used it in so many different ways. But one of my favorite ways to use it is always as a salad dressing. It's absolutely insane because it's the perfect amount of sweet and tart. That you want, imagine like you're using lemon on a salad, or imagine using like a, let's say, a flavored fruit vinegar. It still has a little tang of fruit and still has nice acidity, so it's fantastic and so versatile, even as a souring agent for some soups. You know, if you've got like a really good pumpkin or butternut or sweet potato soup, like a little swish on that just garnish at the end and serve would be really lovely. So it's just about understanding the variety of ways that you can use an ingredient, and then suddenly realizing, oh, the whole world is your oyster. It doesn't have to be used in a Middle Eastern way. You can manipulate it to suit your preferences.
Well, I'm so pleased that you are as in love with preserved lemons as I am. And Peter just found some organic lemons for me to make my next batch of them. They really elevate any dish you make, don't they?
And there is a great preserved lemon martini in there for you, Peter.
Oh, good.
Like that.
Oh, that sounds
now
perfect.
Now, that actually is one that I did a little bit of taste testing on the shoot just to get the balance right. And we had so many recipes to cook through that day, so it was a fun departure from the chopping board, briefly.
The other thing is, you know, you just don't encounter freca as much as you should. I think it's absolutely marvelous grain.
Yes, it's lovely. But the great thing about freca, because freca essentially is just green, smoked green wheat. So it's harvested early and then smoked. And it's, you know, wonderful. And it's got three times the fiber of regular wheat and a lot less of the allergens. But if you don't have freca, I strongly recommend just using good brown rice because it has that chew, the same sort of chewy texture and a little husk on it that kind of still, you know, gives you that sustainability for it to absorb the salad dressing and hold on to it without turning to mush. So there are always alternatives. People recommend spelt, you know, barley. There are always something else that you can put. You know, so many uses of freca, the same sort of uses of freca you can use other things for. So I hope that people never feel discouraged by changing an ingredient.
Right. And, of course, you are a lover of slaw, and you have a modern take on it, which I really admire.
Yes,
tell us about your Eastern slaw.
So the Eastern slaw is a selection of different vegetables that I would choose to put in my slaw, and, you know, again, free reign to chop and change that as much as you like with what you have. But I think what really makes it is sometimes I find some mayonnaises can be really heavy, you know, heavily bound, and the consistency isn't always right, and maybe acidity is missing. But I really like lightening things with, say, yogurt, and also love horseradish. And it just gives you a little piquancy, like a little spicy back note, but it's not a chili back note, but it's interesting. And it just feels, because there's fennel in there, the fennel feels really kind of like cleaning as well. It's a very interesting flavor in a slaw. And I love it. I can eat it for days and put it in baguette sandwiches with like turkey and, oh, so good.
Well, you know, I make one with a fennel bulb, and celeriac, apple, and sliced green and black olives.
Love that.
Yeah, it's wonderful with a lemon dressing. That's my favorite kind of dressing anyhow. But I'm going to take, I'm going to steal some of your ingredients from your Eastern slaw and enlarge mine. Yes. So,
with pleasure.
And you also love broccoli.
I do. I have a thing for broccoli. I just love vegetables, in all fairness. There's very few vegetables that I'm like, meh. You know, I really like them. And I especially love getting my greens. And I love just putting broccoli in pasta. I just love it. Uh-huh. Maybe unconventional, but I put loads of broccoli and greens and cabbage just hacked up and stir-fried and, you know, tossed in a pasta.
I think that sounds great. And yeah. You have some interesting takes on cauliflower. You pick out these things that we're all supposed to be eating, and we like well enough, but they get to be boring unless you do something special to them. And that's what you tend to do here, like this turmeric and spice marinated cauliflower sounds divine, and it looks easy.
Yeah, it's fairly easy. It's like basically frying cauliflower that's been spiced up. But it's what makes it, because the spice alone on the cauliflower, like if you just ate it just like that, it would probably be not terribly pleasant because it's quite abrasive. But the sauce on top and the yogurt, again, it's just like layering the flavor to perfectly contrast each other. But it's very simple, and you know, I could quite happily forego everything else and share one of those whole with another person for dinner easily, because it just has it appeals on every level. It's like the complete meal, one dish, a humble vegetable with more vegetables and a yogurt. You know, it's great.
Well, yeah. I mean, one of the ways I'm using this book is things that we make regularly, and you give a new twist on it that's going to really up our,
our
repertoire here. And you also, I don't think I ever registered that there were that many varieties of harissa.
Yeah, it's, I guess it's because harissa is just made using different chilies. I don't think there's any hard and fast rule. I think in the areas that it's made using whatever is available locally, but a combination of several different ones to create a particular blend or signature heat. And then onions, garlic, whatever else they want to put in it, some moderate spices, you know, and here, for example, there is a great company that do this beautiful rose harissa, and that is...
Yeah, you call for that in a number of recipes. What is it?
Yes. Oh, it's a brand that specifically create this, but even if it didn't have rose in it, let me tell you, it is the most beautiful consistency and flavor of all of the harissas. It doesn't have that really acerbic, bitter burn. It's a very refined heat. It's powerful, but it doesn't feel abrasive, and you can use it in moderate quantity and stir it into a yogurt to get a gentle tickle, or you can, you know, use it in much fiercer quantity from everything from pasta sauces to, you know, marinades to bases for, you know, stews and soups, whatnot. It's just so versatile. I love it. I can't function in my kitchen without it for you know, because I use it in Chinese recipes, I use it in Italian recipes, I use it wherever I need a chili compound to enrich something, and it just works beautifully.
Yeah, well, I'm going to add it to my pantry.
Well, we have some.
We have some?
Yeah, I suspected as much. Came from the Teeny Spice Company in Vermont.
Oh, wow.
And it's in the same series as that West African curry powder that we like so much.
Oh yeah!
In fact, it's going to be applied to this evening's dinner, which is barbecue chicken thighs, and it's been used there several times, and Anne just hasn't noticed.
Wow! But here you have
so versatile.
But this is, I decided the reason I'm so taken with your cookbook is we like the same things, like octopus and squid.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. I always have to tone it down to just one recipe or one recipe of each, you know, because otherwise I think it creeps people out. Not everybody does love them, and I think like them and they've tried them, it's probably just because they had a bad version of, you know. They're just so wonderful. I love it, and we eat tons of it here in Europe.
Well, anyhow, listeners, this is Sabrina Geyer. And it's Sirocco, and it's fabulous flavors from the Middle East, and you better believe that they are. And you're going to want to make these.
Thank you.
I mean, they're cookbooks you can look at, and the pictures are certainly lovely, but this, you're going to want to actually make this, unless you can convince Sabrina to come and cook for you. So that's always a possibility, right, Sabrina?
Absolutely, absolutely. With pleasure.
Well, thank you so much for talking to us about it, and thank you so much for these wonderfully inventive recipes.
Thank you. My absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And to finish out today's program, well, the segment's called N-Tube, and you want to give a quick explanation why?
Yeah, well, I was about to say, I mean, I like most of our guests on this show, but I was particularly fond of Richard LaSalle, our next guest, because he had such a great sense of humor and such an interesting background. And the product is, I mean, I love the product. It's they call them flavor bombs, and they come in tubes. You just squeeze them in. And
it's sort of like toothpaste, but in fact, be careful you don't mix it up with the toothpaste.
Yeah, well, voila, you then have curry, you have harissa, and you have a new one coming out that he can talk about.
Yeah, a range of products coming out. So it's not just a two-trick pony or a three-trick pony. It's going to be a five-trick pony, and who knows in the future. So here's the story of N-Tube.
Richard LaSalle, I mean, you've certainly shaken up the specialty food industry with your product, N-Tube, but, you know, starting before that, your background is fascinating.
Right.
People will notice your accent's English, but you're French. LaSalle is certainly a French name.
Right.
You are an artist. But you grew up in a family that was food forward, right?
Right, yes.
Yeah, feel free to jump in here and tell us specifics about your background.
I grew up in, we spent all our summers in the Provence, in the south of France. So my parents have a house down there, a farmhouse. So we grew all our own food and went shopping in the local markets, and it was always, everything was about food. You know, breakfast was about discussing lunch, and
I know.
Then we'd go shopping for lunch, and then we'd make lunch, eat lunch, and discuss dinner, and then go shopping for dinner. It was all about food.
It was very Provence, huh? Yes.
Totally.
So, yeah, well, I love it there, too. But how did you start training as an artist?
Well, my great-grandfather was an artist, my grandmother was an artist, my other grandfather was an artist, my father was a painter, my mother's a potter,
Really?
It was just all in the family, yeah, so we did, apart from eating all day long, we also did painting, various other projects. My father was a muralist, he painted murals in the old-fashioned egg tempera style.
Egg tempera?
Egg tempera, yes.
Wow.
How they used to do all the murals.
Yeah, but that really is, it's tedious.
Yeah, well, he used to have me, grinding up all the colors and mixing all the colors together. And, so I got a real taste of all these different earth pigments and earthy colors, the yellow ochres, the red ochres, and all the various blues and greens that you use from the natural pigments.
Why did he do that? I mean, by his time being an artist, it was centuries before.
Well, he's a very old-fashioned kind of guy, and uh-huh. He also had an antique store, so he dealt with 15th century European furniture and works of art. So we were very much embedded in history and the qualities of times gone past, and craftsmanship and all that kind of thing. So I think that had a large influence, you know.
Much seems to have.
I mean, that's a natural pathway to making spices in tubes that look like toothpaste.
They all look like
I can see the connection.
Yeah, even actually now I take the tubes with my children and we squirt it around on bits of paper and we make paintings out of them.
Do you really?
Yeah, because the colors are very important to the product line.
Right.
You know, we have the lovely rusty red from the harissa. We have the new curry, which is turmeric, which has got a beautiful yellow. We have a beet-infused umeboshi.
Now, what is that?
It's a Japanese salted plum.
Yeah, we didn't get that one. Is that on the market yet?
No, it comes out in August.
Oh, okay, that's why we didn't get it. So it's Japanese plum.
Yeah, it's a salted fermented plum, and it's been used as a health tonic for centuries. The samurais used to eat it before they went into battle to stabilize their bodies.
What kind of plum is it? What's it called?
It's called an umi plum.
That's umi not the plum. One. I have an Australian company that sent me something called a, it's not Dakota plum, something, and it's a healing thing, too.
But you said it's dehydrated, and when you hydrate it, it tastes terrible.
You're supposed to mix it in water, and it doesn't dissolve.
it's a little green plum that's quite acidic, and what they do is they soak it with salt and shiso leaves,
and
they ferment it, and then they turn it into a paste.
Well, I think that must be what I have, but it's supposed to be for healing and so forth. And
yeah, it's an alkaline. It's an alkaline balancer for the body. So
it tasted terrible. It was absolutely awful.
It was obviously doing you good, right?
So. Well, I don't. Well, I mean, I tried it once. I couldn't stomach it, and it never was dissolved properly. But they said they only market it as in that format because the fruit. It goes bad as soon as you pick it. Is that what you're talking about?
I don't know about that. I mean, we basically get our base product from Japan.
I see.
And they turn it into puree.
Yeah.
So they're actually it's actually on a boat right now, heading to our facility in Montreal where we make our products.
I bet you this is the same bomb. I mean, I've never heard anything quite like this. But it really does taste bad. I don't know how you make it taste good for your product.
Well, it tastes pretty good to me, so I don't know if it's the same plum or whether we just got different tastes. I don't know.
I see. All right, well, it remains to be seen.
It's like a salty sour flavor, you know.
Yeah, but this is sour, all right. It was bitter, actually, I think.
Well, now, did we?
No, it shouldn't be bitter.
Did we really explain what makes this product unique aside from the wonderful flavors? I mean, it's the packaging, right?
Well, here's two things. He says it's extremely healthy. Why don't you tell us about your products, Richard, instead of our describing them?
Sure. Well, basically I wanted to make, I've always loved harissa, and that's where I started here. And it's the healthy aspects of the cayenne peppers and the paprika, and we also added an Amazonian berry called an acerola berry.
Right.
Which has got 400 times the vitamin C content of orange, so it's extremely high vitamin C content. So basically, you know, each teaspoon you have gives you 25% of your daily vitamin C needs.
Well, how much do you have to eat to get that?
Just one teaspoon.
Oh, that's good.
So you just have, I have it on toast in the morning to set up my day.
Okay.
And basically with the vitamin C, the cayenne pepper, it's a really good way of preventing any sorts of flus or, you know, things like that from getting into your body, because it just cleans you out and it stabilizes you. So I wanted to have each of the products we do have some sort of health attributes, and that, obviously the curry's got a lot of turmeric, and turmeric right now.
Yeah, we did a whole thing. I did a whole article on the turmeric from the fresh root.
Yeah, turmeric and cumin and all these types of spices, they've just been used for centuries for medicinal reasons.
Right.
So, and also, obviously, to, you know, bring flavor to anything. So, you know, you can use our products as a flavor bomb for anything. I was in a hotel recently in Vancouver, and I ordered the hotel pasta, and it was a rather mundane spaghetti bolognese.
Uh-huh. So you squeeze.
Squeezed a little bit of the curry on tube into it and mixed it up, and all of a sudden it was a delicious meal.
Uh-huh. Did you give some to the chef, or is it still, or is it your secret?
No, I did. I went downstairs and gave him a couple of tubes and said, "Hey, try this."
And he liked it?
Oh, they loved it, yeah.
So you have another customer just like that, huh?
Hopefully. I think what's interesting about this is that you can, you know, basically you can turn any meal into a delicious occasion. So it's a question of the consumer's sort of understanding the flexibility and the versatility of the product. It's not something with the curry, for example, if you want to make a really good curry dish, you just put a few teaspoons of that curry in your base, and all of a sudden you've got all the relevant spices to make it a really good curry, without having to shop for individual spices and look for all these different bits and pieces, which is sometimes kind of hard to find. So it's a convenience factor. And of course, being in the tube as opposed to being in a jar, you take your quantity, you put the lid on, and it keeps.
How long does it keep?
Well, put it this way, we recommend 3 months on the tube, because that's what we need to do. But I've had some in my fridge for over a year, and it still tastes amazing.
Don't tell. Peter's going to tell you about his carrot pickle.
Sounds like my famous carrot pickle.
Well, yeah. I think we had it for 15 years.
Yeah, I bought a large jar of Indian pickle.
Carrot pickle.
Yeah. And it was probably in the refrigerator for about 15 years.
Yeah.
It never lost its potency. It was perfectly fine, and it kind of dried out. And I guess when we bought a new refrigerator, it was time for it to
the door.
But I did feel kind of sad.
Yeah,
well, I'm hoping people use the tube up before 15 years. Not such a good business model there.
But this was a very large jar of carrot pickle.
Oh, yeah, it was because it was a large jar.
Now, Richard, you have all this interesting background. I mean, your life, your interest in all this sustainable do-it-yourself feeding, food growing, producing.
Yeah.
And then you did 2 decades in advertising and entertainment. I'm working with brands like Nike and Rolling Stones. What was that like?
Well, I've always been interested in design, so when I moved to Los Angeles the first time, I thought, what am I going to do here in Los Angeles? And I started off painting some murals for people and ended up painting murals for people like Miles Copeland and Daryl Hannah and various entertainment people. And then it was like, okay, well, maybe I should design something in the movie industry. That seems to be what happens here. So I ended up moving into that industry. Did a number of movies and then a lot of commercials, a lot of music videos, which was pretty fun. Done music videos for Madonna, U2, Beyonce, for all those people.
Oh, that would have been interesting, huh?
Yeah, it was super fascinating. But, you know, as the years went by, I was like, okay, now I want to get back to what I really love to do, which is eating and creating things. So that's why I've ventured back into the food direction of things.
But what steers you towards this particular item?
I love the tube. Uh-huh. It's just such an iconic, especially with it's like a polished aluminum iconic tube. Reminds me of an aeroplane or some fantastic thing like that. And then just the convenience of it. We always had tubes in our fridge growing up. And they're not that big in the States, food in tubes. So I thought it would be a unique delivery system, and it would be something that would make the product stand out. So we're not just another jar of harissa on the shelf, and there's quite a few of them now.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I have more than one in my refrigerator.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it makes the product stand out as something a little different, more unique, and kind of special. I think that the tube has a kind of preciousness to it. It feels like it's not just a throwaway. I mean, you do end up throwing it away, but it's got something tangibly iconic about it that's enjoyable to hold and to use and to, you know, to apply with in your daily life.
I'm glad you didn't use plastic for the tube. I hate those plastic tubes that everything comes in and out.
Absolutely. I hate that too. And just the whole idea of having plastic is pretty appalling. So that's where we went for the natural box, natural cardboard box, and the sort of block printing idea with the graphics and stuff to keep it, you know, kind of modern and up to date and in tune with what's going on in the world right now.
Well, you developed this in November of 2015, and already you're a sensation with the specialty food industry. I mean, that has to feel remarkable to you.
Oh, it's fantastic. It's fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, you won a Silver Sophie, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and what category was it? Condiments?
It was in mixing sauces.
Oh, that's right.
Mixing
okay.
sauces. It seems that there's a variety of categories it could have gone into.
Uh-huh. Well, they sort of overlap, those categories. They're not all clear-cut, actually.
Yeah, they do. I think next year we'll probably put a few different products because we're developing a whole bunch. You know, we'll put them in different categories as well.
What kind of products are in the pipeline?
Well, the idea is just to take us around the world. So we have the North African harissa, we have the Indian curry, we have the Japanese miboshi. Next coming up, we have a Mexican-inspired burnt habanero tamarind paste.
Oh, wow.
Which I'm super excited about.
Yeah, we have a cousin who grows tamarind, if you're interested.
No,
organic tamarind. Yeah. In Tasmania, though. It's a little hard to...
Oh, well, you know, we import stuff. We could look into that, for sure. Then we're also developing a Thai green chili paste, which would be like a lemongrass Thai green chili flavor. We're working on a za'atar from Palestine.
I love it.
Yeah, a za'atar paste. And essentially we're starting off with chili-based products so that we can have all of our products sitting next to each other on the shelf and not have, you know, one product over in the section over there and another product over in a section over there, but to have them all together so they can be a family, a happy family.
Well, you really thought about this. You're really impressive.
He's a marketeer, isn't he?
He's
a professional marketeer, for heaven's sake. Why wouldn't he figure it out? What I'm trying
to... It's a small part of it. Yeah, so to have, you know, to have five or six products with specific, very specific color and from very specific regions around the world, you know, to get a real ethnic diversity of flavors. So you could say to yourself, one day you want to have a Japanese-inspired dish, and one day you want to have an Indian-inspired dish, and another day you can have a Mexican-inspired dish. So you can really like open up your, you know, broaden your horizons when it comes to cooking in your kitchen.
Well, I think you got yourself an idea here, and I hope that these products, I'll get to see them as they come out too.
I hope so too. But you know, we've gone since November. We've gone. We're in like 175 stores or something, and spreading all the time. We've just done a deal with some friends in Australia. They're going to start importing down there. We're working on exporting to Europe and Japan, and just to keep spreading the word, spreading the love.
Well, I mean, I will wish you success, but I mean, you're well on your way to. You've already achieved.
Yeah, I don't know whether we wish you God bless America, Rule Britannia, or Vive la France, but maybe all three.
And whichever of those seems appropriate, we have to say goodbye until next week. We hope you'll join us again, same time, same place. And in the meantime,
bye-bye.